Hello, and welcome to the first in a series of podcasts by Voyaging Through History, the Mayflower, and Britain. We're an AHRC-funded project examining the legacy of the Mayflower story in Britain and the contribution of British poets, novelists, painters, and musicians to the development of what is an incredibly important myth both for Britain and America as we approach the 400th anniversary of the settlement of New Plymouth. For those new to the narrative of the 1620 voyage and the settlement of New Plymouth, I'll summarise it briefly. In the early 17th century, a group of religious dissenters, Brownist separatists to give them their proper title, mostly from the English Midlands, emigrated to Leyden, Holland to escape persecution. Finding the atmosphere a little too liberal for their rather strict puritanical views, in 1620 they undertook another voyage across the Atlantic to New England, founding the colony of New Plymouth in modern-day Massachusetts. Over time, the story of the settlement became a foundation myth, weaving its way into the tapestry of American national identity, even becoming associated with the Thanksgiving celebration. Much work has already been done by American scholars looking at the American aspect of this story, but less so on the contribution of British authors, so this is where our project really comes in. Now, the title of today's podcast is Radical Pilgrims, and on first glance, this seems to be a highly conservative myth. A band of God-fearing, hard-working pilgrims who found a nation. And it has been used in this guise many times before. But from another perspective, there's always been a radical, even revolutionary element to this narrative. Notably, New England revolutionaries repurposed the myth in the 1760s and the 1770s to help in the fight against Britain. But what about authors closer to home? Did they ever use this story, which is as much myth as it is history, in the cause of radical social change here? Well, we'll be looking at the contribution of three authors today, Ebenezer Elliott, Elizabeth Barrett Browning, and John Boyle O'Reilly, from British and Irish backgrounds, who repurposed the myth for radical political ends. The first figure we'll be looking at today is Ebenezer Elliott, and Elliott was an active participant in the Chartist movement and the anti-Corn Law campaign, which earned him the title of the Corn Law Rhymer because of his fiery political poetry. The Corn Laws were tariffs and other trade restrictions on the import of grain, which kept food prices artificially high in Britain, something the Chartists campaigned very strongly against. Now, Eliot's poetry was central to the development of Chartist verse, with Martha Vicarness referring to Eliot as the most important predecessor of the Chartist poets. Eliot's poetry was highly popular amongst readers sympathetic to political reform, and he helped encourage working class poetry in the burgeoning Chartist movement. By the end of his life, Eliot's status was such that even his enemies in the Tory press, and he had many, had to recognise his power as a poet and a political activist. Writing in 1850, The Spectator, though resistive to Eliot's vulgar and violent diatribes in verse as it described them, acquiesced that Eliot had more genius, power, pathos and delicacy than any poet from the people except Burns. Charles Dickens, a contemporary, further commented that Eliot would have been a poet in all that constitutes poetry had the Corn Laws never existed. So how did Eliot's activism take on the myth of the Mayflower? Well, in 1836 he published a poem in Tate's magazine entitled The Pilgrim Fathers, which is a searing condemnation of political failures in Britain. This myth was first popularised by Felicia Hemans and her well-known poem The Landing of the Pilgrim Fathers in New England. So the narrative was an appropriate choice for Eliot, as he wanted to create works that were familiar to a broad and popular audience. Scholars have described Eliot's poetry as being characterised by emotional bombast, fervid language and urgent appeals to God. The Pilgrim Fathers certainly contains all of these elements. Eliot provides a fiery invective that castigates modern Britain, written in the voice of the Pilgrim Fathers speaking from across the Atlantic. I'll just read aloud the first couple of stanzas from Eliot's poem so you can get a feel for what we're discussing today. So this is the opening of Eliot's 1836 poem, The Pilgrim Fathers. A voice of grief and anger, of pity mixed with scorn, moans over the waters of the west, through fire and darkness born, and fiercer voices join it, a wild triumphant yell, for England's foes, on ocean slain, have heard it where they fell. What is that voice which cometh across the sceptred sea, the voice of men who left their homes to make their children free, of men whose hearts were torches for freedom's quenchless fire, of men whose mothers have brought forth the sire of Franklin's sire. So in this poem, using the origin myth of the Mayflower, the United States is positioned as a land of freedom in stark contrast to modern Britain. Speaking from the grave, the Pilgrim Fathers are disturbed to find the people of their homeland reduced to soulless slaves. Eliot argues that these were men whose hearts were torches for freedom's quenchless fire. Whilst clearly ahistorical, Eliot is working in the tradition of British radicalism that stretches back to the fiery oratory and poetry of John Thirlwall following the French Revolution. From this perspective, the Pilgrim Fathers utilises traditional radical vocabulary and invective to agitate for parliamentary reform. As Nigel Cross comments, Eliot wrote unrepentant political poetry, exhorting the working classes to commit themselves to the struggle against landlords, employers and government. By leveraging the story of the Mayflower for the ends of British radicalism, Eliot demonstrates the malleability of the Pilgrim Fathers as a cultural narrative. The poem was a huge success, quickly republished in the Leeds Times, the Western Times, the Brighton Patriot and the Leicester Chronicle. The poem went on to be reprinted throughout the century in both radical and more mainstream newspapers. Indeed, its suitability as a vehicle for reform was noted by the Leicester Chronicle, which said, "Here we have a voice from the shades of our forefathers who preferred to trust themselves to the uncultivated wilds of America than to the despotism of a Stuart. This voice was heard by Ebenezer Eliot in one of his moments of poetic inspiration, and he has echoed the spirit-stirring cry of the millions of these isles, clothed in his own immortal verse." So you can certainly hear how warmly Eliot's poetry was received by the political and the radical press at this time. And Eliot's skill in writing poetry was that he knew how to appeal to a mass and popular audience. He knew what topics to pick. And this provides an important indication of the growth of popular political knowledge regarding the Pilgrim Fathers at this time in Britain. Eliot evidently considered the Mayflower story appropriate as a subject matter for political reform, something familiar and knowledgeable to many people. In doing so, he promotes the idea of the Pilgrim Fathers as figures of liberty, fighting against oppression in order to castigate the modern British state. This strategy in selecting the Mayflower for a vehicle for radical reform is certainly a very successful one for Eliot, as the poem continues to be reprinted over the century. In the 1840s, the Pilgrim Fathers was reprinted in works such as John Cleves' The English Chartist Circular, and in the 1850s, the poem was put to even more radical uses in The Red Republican. So The Red Republican was a socialist newspaper founded by George Julian Harney after he left the Northern Star due to a disagreement with its owner, Fergus O'Connor, around Harney's radical socialism. Now, the Northern Star was one of the leading radical newspapers of its era. So if you're going to get fired from the Northern Star for being too radical, you can kind of see how extreme you were as a figure in that period. It had a very short run, and one of the things it was notable for was the first English translation of the Communist Manifesto by Scottish socialist and feminist Helen Macfarlane. The very same edition of The Red Republican carried Eliot's Pilgrim Fathers in a feature entitled Poetry for the People. So you can see the connection between Eliot's poetry and new movements of working class radicalism, such as Marxism and socialism, that are taking place at this time. So Eliot's success as a radical author had a significant influence on the recognition of labouring class poetry and the growth of labouring class politics. And the Pilgrim Fathers was an integral component of this success. So the next figure we're going to be considering is Elizabeth Barrett Browning. She was a contemporary of Eliot's, but she couldn't really be described as a radical in quite the same sense. She was much more accepted as a poet in the polite and the literary press, but she was also a staunch advocate of abolition, and she wrote powerfully campaigning for this, mostly targeting the United States, which is of course going through a huge controversy around the abolition of slavery at this time. Browning's most well-known work on abolition is her 1848 poem, The Runaway Slave at Pilgrim's Point. Now, this is a highly controversial mid-19th century poem that grapples with issues of race, slavery, and injustice from an explicitly abolitionist perspective. She originally intended this to be published in the 1848 edition of The Liberty Bell, which is an anti-slavery annual based in Boston at this time. Browning feared the work was too ferocious, perhaps, for the Americans to publish. It's a direct quotation from her. Despite Browning's anxiety, The Runaway Slave was carried by the Liberty Bell and became one of her best-known poems on both sides of the Atlantic. The manuscript of the poem was actually originally titled The Black and Mad at Pilgrim's Point, indicating how foregrounded issues of race and slavery are to the work, but also the centrality of Plymouth Rock to the narrative. The speaker of the poem, an unnamed fugitive slave woman, stands at Pilgrim's Rock in an ironic inversion of the history of liberty that had become an integral part of the Mayflower narrative and American national identity. Now, Ebenezer Elliott, quite recently, had used this same concept of liberty to castigate modern Britain, but Browning does something else. She actually attacks it directly. So the poem opens with the speaker addressing the pilgrims, and I'll just give you the first few stanzas so we can get a feel of what Browning was trying to achieve here. I stand on the mark beside the shore of the first white pilgrim's bended knee, where exile turned to ancestor, and God was thanked for liberty. I have run through the night, my skin is as dark, I bend my knee down on this mark, I look on the sky and see. O pilgrim souls, I speak to you. I see you come out proud and slow from the land of the spirits pale as dew, and round me you go. O pilgrims, I have grasped and run all night long from the whips of one who in your name works sin and woe. So, through the voice of the runaway slave, Browning is directly challenging the historical association of the Pilgrim Fathers as the origin myth for the United States, for a nation founded on liberty. In its stead, Browning presents another association, that of the intimate connection between race-based slavery and the settlement of North America. The runaway slave sees only the connection between the pilgrims and an inhuman system of human bondage. The Runaway Slave at Pilgrim's Point is a landmark publication in British Mayflower fiction, one that marks an important disjuncture with the celebratory and commemorative narrative of the Pilgrim Fathers often received from British writers. Indeed, it speaks volumes about the attitudes of the 1920 tercentenary celebrations that they proudly look back to the poetry of Felicia Hemans for an aggrandizing example of British Mayflower poetry, but they conspicuously ignored the other famous example from the 19th century, the dark, the critical, and the graphic poetry of Browning's Runaway Slave at Pilgrim's Point. The final figure from our group of three authors we're looking at today was certainly both a radical and a revolutionary, there's no doubt about that. This is John Ball O'Reilly. He was a member of the Irish Revolutionary Brotherhood, also known as the IRB or the Fenian Brotherhood. Before we go into O'Reilly's contribution to radical Mayflower history, we have to give some details of his life because it's an absolutely fascinating backstory. So in 1866, his secret revolutionary activities and memberships were discovered by the British authorities, and he was charged and convicted of treason. This carried a death sentence. However, due to his young age at 22, the sentence was later commuted to 20 years penal servitude and transportation to Australia. He was transported on the last convict ship ever to leave Britain, the Hougoumont, which arrived laden with 279 prisoners sentenced to transportation in Australia. So already you can see why O'Reilly might have been attracted to the myth of the Mayflower. And ever the writer and the propagandist, O'Reilly actually handwrote seven editions of a newspaper entitled The Wild Goose on board the ship to keep up the morale of his fellow convicts. He found lasting fame, however, for staging an audacious escape from the penal colony of Western Australia. So, with help with a number of locals sympathetic to his cause, O'Reilly manages to escape on board the US whaling ship, the Gazelle. And Riley eventually disembarks in Philadelphia in November of 1869. Jeffrey Roach recorded the event in the life of John Boyle O'Reilly. His first act after landing was to make a votive offering to liberty. He presented himself before the United States District Court and took out his first papers of naturalization. O'Reilly eventually settled in Boston, where he found work as a reporter on the Boston Pilot. His first major assignment was to cover the 1870 Fenian raid on Quebec in Canada. He would remain associated with the Fenians for the rest of his life, becoming a well-known Irish revolutionary figure in America. And it was O'Reilly's status as a leading literary figure with connections to Boston that saw him asked to write a poem for the dedication of the National Monument to the Pilgrim Fathers in Plymouth. The choice of a Catholic Irishman for the role, rather than a native of New England, was controversial, as you can imagine. Some commented that O'Reilly had extolled the narrow Puritans and forgotten their intolerance, and accused him of having brought the Blarney Stone into conjunction with Plymouth Rock. However, the poem was well received by many in New England, and in keeping with O'Reilly's revolutionary sentiments regarding Ireland, the poem makes strong censure of British power and oppression. The antithesis of British rule are the Pilgrim Fathers, who, as emigres from despotism, become the founders of a utopian kingdom, not of kings, but of men. So again, I'll just give you a very brief extract from the beginning of the poem. This is the Pilgrim Fathers. One righteous word for law, the common will, one living truth of faith, God regnant still, one primal test of freedom, all combined, one sacred revolution, change of mind, one trust unfailing for the night and need. The tyrant flower shall cast the freedom seed. So held they firm, the fathers aye to be, from home to Holland, Holland to the sea, pilgrims for manhood in their little ship, hope in each heart and prayer on every lip. They could not live by king-made codes and creeds. They chose the path where every footstep leads. So the poem makes use of rhyming pentameter. The opening of the poem uses couplets to convey a sense of rhythm and forward momentum towards a sacred revolution and freedom from king-made codes and creeds. Overall, this is a poem full of radical terminology. It explicitly radicalizes the Pilgrim Fathers and brings them into conversation with the Fenian revolutionary cause. By echoing well-known Chartist and Irish radical vocabulary, O'Reilly is conducting an ambitious synthesis of different radical traditions. Rather than a simple celebratory ode befitting a memorial address, O'Reilly's poem is a combative and controversial celebration of separatism and revolution. This positions the poem as a unique ideological variant at odds with much Mayflower fiction towards the close of the 19th century. O'Reilly actually died in 1890, which was less than a year after the first recital of his poem, and obituaries from this time, they make heavy reference to his contribution to the Mayflower Memorial. The Glasgow Herald made the following comments. As showing how completely O'Reilly had won the hearts of the people, I may mention that last December, by the invitation of the Pilgrim Society, he read a vigorous poem at Plymouth on the spot where the pilgrims landed. That an Irishman and a Catholic should be the chosen bard of the descendants of the pilgrims at their most sacred anniversary would have been enough, one would think, to make Governor Bradford and Miles Standish turn in their graves. Continuing in somewhat guarded language, given his anti-British revolutionary connections, the Glasgow Herald praised his poetry as expressed with energy and without restraint, while suggesting that the narrow limits of his early education and participation in Fenian plots stood in the way of his development as a poet. Irish newspapers were much less guarded in their praise of O'Reilly. This is an extract from The Flag of Ireland. There could not be a more remarkable testimony to the appreciation and sympathy with which his poetical genius was regarded than the fact that last year he was Poet of All America, chosen to fulfill what could be the duty of an American laureate, namely to compose and commemorate an ode for the tercentenary of the landing of the Pilgrim Fathers in New England. He was thus acting as an interpreter and uniter between races that even in the New World had been living in misunderstanding and antagonism. O'Reilly's 1889 poetic address, I think, really demonstrates the ability of the Mayflower mythos to incorporate disparate and sometimes contradictory elements within the same narrative. For example, Ebenezer Elliott and O'Reilly both celebrate the Pilgrim Fathers as people that fought for liberty against a tyrannical government, whereas Elizabeth Barrett Browning, she does the opposite. She attacks the Pilgrim Fathers as people that began a nation that was built on slavery. The myth and the central story remains the same, but the way it's interpreted and used by different authors changes. So today I've gone over very briefly three different authors and three different controversies of 19th century politics. You have abolitionism, you have Chartism, and you have Irish republicanism. And what we may see as a very conservative myth, actually, if you examine it closely, becomes a very radical myth depending on its interpretation. Those familiar with the myth of the Mayflower today in Britain probably associate it with colonialism, and that's certainly been a very integral part of the way it's propagated itself through history. But I hope today I've been able to show you some of the important ways radicals and revolutionaries repackaged and reinterpreted this myth themselves. If you'd like any more information on our project and the research that we're doing, you can have a look at our website, which is www.voyagingthroughhistory.exeter.ac.uk. Thanks everybody for listening.